Wading through some pretty deep water. That's last week introduced Melchizedek. He's the guy that pops up, a king that pops up one time, Genesis chapter 14, as Abraham has defeated the kings that have taken Lot and Sodom and Gomorrah and those little cities captive. And he's returning victoriously, and he's confronted by the king of Sodom, and then he's confronted by this king of Salem, king of righteousness, king of peace, he's called, by the name of Melchizedek. And Melchizedek's really being set forth as a type of Jesus. As you know, under the Mosaic law, the priest that served on behalf of man God was from the family of Levi, more specifically the family of Aaron. And so Melchizedek kind of comes onto the scene as a type of a new priesthood that Jesus is going to accomplish. It's just impressive to see the omniscience of God as for, I don't know, 1,500 years, people did not know who in the world Melchizedek was or why he was mentioned for those three short verses in Scripture. There's a brief allusion to him in Psalm 110:4 where it's mentioned, the Lord is sworn and you will not turn away from it. You're a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. And they had no idea what that meant either until Jesus comes onto the scene. They said everything in the Old Testament is pointing to Jesus. And everything in the New Testament manifests with Jesus, and everything after Jesus is looking forward to his return. So, as he's writing to these Christians who are Jewish, that are thinking about going back to the law of Moses, back to the Levitical priesthood, he's setting forth to them this convincing reason, this convincing argumentation of the superiority of this new priesthood of whom Jesus is going to be a type of. And so last time we were talking about the three characteristics of Melchizedek's priesthood. Scholars have talked about and debated, well, is a description of Melchizedek here literal, or is it symbolic, or is there something else going on? Because as you look at how he's described in verses 2 and 3, or rather verse 3, he's without father or mother, he is without genealogy, he's to have neither beginning of days nor end of days, and then it says, thirdly, he resembles the Son of God and continues as a priest forever. So, scholars have wondered, was the historical Melchizedek some sort of manifestation of Jesus Christ, or was he just a regular man? And kind of my view of this is that he was just a regular man, and that the things that are mentioned here, strange though they may sound, they really tie into the context of priesthood qualification. That is, his priesthood is said to be without father or mother or genealogy. And some people take that to say he didn't have parents. Rather, what I take it to say is that his genealogy isn't recorded. And I think we mentioned a few of these things in closing last time. I think I might have rushed through them a little bit. The reason this is important because under the Levitical priesthood, you had to be able to prove your genealogy, to show that you were from the family of Aaron. If you could not do that with some sort of official genealogical record, then you were not allowed to labor as a priest. And there was an instance in Nehemiah where he brings several of the, or many of the Jews back to the land of Jerusalem from Babylon. And there are some priests who come along from the lineage of Aaron. But they can't show, they can't authenticate that they come from Aaron's family, genealogically. And as a result of that, they're disqualified for the priesthood service. So this statement here that Melchizedek's priesthood is without father or mother or genealogy, simply I think is a reference to the fact that we're not told. There's no genealogical record as to who his mother and father were. So he just kind of comes onto the scene and then he disappears. No record of his parentage or anything like that, how he ties in. Secondly, he's said to have either beginning of days or end of days. Once again, there are people who've taken that to mean that Melchizedek didn't die. Once again, I think it's a reference to the fact that there's no record of his birth and there's no record of his death. So he comes onto the scene, he leaves, and we're told nothing of how he came into being, and we're told nothing of how his end came to be. Aaron, on the other hand, and all of the high priests, their death were recognized and recorded. You can go back and read of Aaron's death in Numbers 20, 28, as Aaron died and passes the priesthood on to the next. And as the high priest would die, it would pass on high priest to high priest to high priest. Then thirdly, he resembles the Son of God and he continues as a priest forever. So what we observe in this statement is that Jesus is not like Melchizedek. Melchizedek is like Jesus. That's important because the focus isn't Melchizedek. The focus is going to be Jesus. So he resembles the Son of God and continues as a priest forever. It's not that the Son of God resembles him, but he resembles the Son of God. Now the reason Melchizedek came onto the scene in the manner that he did is he's setting forth this type of Jesus, this new priesthood that's going to come, that as genealogically, well, there's no father, mother, or parentage, and we understand that while Jesus had an earthly mother, we're talking about our great high priest in the heavenly places. So Jesus pre-incarnate, Jesus in his state of deity as the Son of God, it can't be said that he has a father, mother, genealogy. So he fits into this type, set forth that Melchizedek did. Secondly, Jesus likewise had in the beginning of days, or end of days, in the beginning, he has no end. And then thirdly, he continues as a priest forever. And that's going to be significant because we'll see how the priesthood passes from person to person under the Levitical priesthood. And then the comparison of the Melchizedekian priesthood is one that just continues perpetually. So Jesus fulfills all of these things that Melchizedek symbolically fulfills. So, let's go on to, let's read a little bit in our text. Hunter, do you mind reading for us? Would you read Hebrews 7, 4 through 10?
See how great this man is. See how great this man was, to whom Abraham, patriarch, gave the tenth of the spoils. And those descendants of Levi, who received the priestly office, have a commandment in the law to take tithes from the people, that is, from the brothers. These also are descended from Abraham, but this man who does not have his descent from them received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. It is beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. In this case, in the one case, tithes are received by one man, but in the other case, by one of whom it is testified that he lives. One might even say that Levi himself, who received tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, for he was still in the loins of his ancestors when Melchizedek met him.
Alright, thank you, sir. Well, let's see if we can generate a little discussion. So what are tithes? Firstly, we'll answer that in the second part of that. What are tithes? Sam? All right.
It's part of the commandment to give back to the Lord.
Okay. Part of the commandment.
Kind of like a tax.
Okay. Kind of like a tax. Is that something we do today?
We do. It's not necessarily.
Okay. Maybe that's a little humbling. 10%. Take your gross income, divide that by 10%. Maybe that's a little humbling, maybe it's not. So, go back to
my... They tithe their funds.
No, you're right. Talking about tithing, there's normally three things that the Israelites tithe. They would tithe, and this was a custom under the old law, I should mention that, where they gave a tenth of their goods to the priests and the Levites. So, you would tithe product of your land, such as your grain. You would tithe the fruit of your trees, such as your oil and your wine, and then you tithe of your flock and herd. So three things, from the ground, from the tree, and from your animals. So it wasn't like a monetary tithe. We're under a completely different economic system, you might say. So those were the things that you would tithe. Go to Numbers chapter 18, and we'll read just a little bit more about that real quick. We'll come back here to verse 7 in just a moment, see the significance of this tithing and how it fits into this discussion with Melchizedek. Numbers 18. Verse 21. To the Levites I have given every tithe in Israel for an inheritance, in return for the service they do, their service in the tent of meeting. So the people of Israel do not come near the tent of meeting, lest they bear sin and die. But the Levites shall do the service of the tent of meeting, and they shall bear their iniquity. It shall be a perpetual statute throughout your generations, and among the people of Israel they shall have no inheritance. For the tithe of the people of Israel, which they present as a contribution to the Lord, I have given to the Levites for an inheritance. Therefore I have said of them, they shall have no inheritance among the people of Israel. So, what tribe didn't have a land allotment given to them when Joshua and the Israelites conquered the land of Canaan? The Levites. What did they receive instead? they received the tithes. And you may remember the statement where the Lord says to Moses, the Levites aren't going to receive an inheritance because they're going to be my inheritance. And so what kind of happened is that God would station various Levitical cities. He would give them certain areas all throughout the region of the land of Israel. And if you think about why that was, so that the people would be able to have access to some sort of priest or some sort of Levitical instruction, they wouldn't have to come all the way to wherever the tent of meeting was. Okay, and so he scattered the Levites all throughout the land. So they'd be here, there, and yonder. And the way the Levites were provided for, because they did receive an inheritance, and they had no land of their own to work, and no possessions such as land, where they could plant and grow and sell and all of that, the people would bring in tithes. Okay? So they tithed their fruit, they tithed their grain, and they tithed their animals, and that was part of how the Levites were provided for. So now back to Hebrews chapter 7. What's the significance of Melchizedek receiving tithes from Abraham? Right? Being a priest. Alright. That's the main point of the first part of the chapter. He's going to do two things. He wants to show Melchizedek as this new priest and show him as being superior to Abraham. And then he's going to show Jesus in the next part of the chapter coming from the order of Melchizedek. So the point of that being, if you put two and two together, Melchizedek's greater than Abraham. Jesus is a priest like Melchizedek, therefore the priestly order of Levi is inferior to the priestly order of Melchizedek, which is one Jesus arises from. So this is going to be a very weighty and hefty argument to the Jews. So verse 4 there kind of highlights that, where it says, see how great this man was, to whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth of the spoils. So before we move past tithing, I know I was going to ask this at some point in time, so I think I answered it already. Tithing is not commanded under the New Testament. So anybody want to take a shot at why that is, or why that may be?
Jesus don't need any support?
Okay. It's all his anyway, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So if you think about it, though, the church is a new Israel. And we do take a collection, we do take up contributions, monetary contributions, but we don't tithe. That's more so what I was getting at.
We don't have an earthly priesthood,
but we've got support.
Okay.
Yeah, I think both of y'all kind of got what I was getting at. And y'all are right on the technicality. There's no priesthood, no earthly priesthood, like the Old Testament tithes was for the Levites. That I was kind of coming at it from another angle. So Jesus doesn't need our money, Jesus doesn't need our possessions. That being said, there are contributions from the congregation of God's people that do support the work of the Lord. And as Whitney and Johnny, both of you guys mentioned, and this is kind of where I was coming at, is he wants us to give from the heart. They were commanded, you give 10%. Didn't matter if you gave grudgingly, or it didn't matter if you gave with regret, or it didn't matter how you felt about it, you gave 10% if you were going to obey the law. But then you go over to 2 Corinthians and other letters, and what you find out is that God isn't looking to extract some sort of contribution by which he's going to accomplish his work among his people. He says, we give from the heart, and we give generously. So that's kind of the end where I was coming from, but everybody with all the comments really fit in as to answering the question. Yes? Okay. All right. And there was a term that you use that's oftentimes used for your offering. You remember what that is to highlight that aspect where God is the priority, an Old Testament offering? Kind of a vague question, Tommy.
Yes.
Okay. Best? Yeah. They called it the first fruit. So the best is the first fruit. That which came first, that which was of the best quality, as you pointed out. In fact, it really becomes an issue, you know, as you kind of trace the history of the people of Israel. They may go through the motions of tithing, but by the time you get to the close of the Old Testament, they weren't giving the best. They were bringing offerings that were inferior.
Minor.
You know, In fact, some people take that problem all the way back to who? Cain and Abel, right? We don't know what it was that caused Cain's offering to be rejected by the Lord. Scholars and people and Christians have speculated all sorts of things, but one of the common speculations is that he didn't bring his best, the best of his grain, the best from the ground. So whatever that was, that's been a problem that plagues God's people. And can we say that's a problem that plagues God's people today? I don't think that's a problem that we've recovered from either. Yes, sir.
Back then, they did not have a lot of money. They may have had some gold bars or silver bars or things like that, but mostly it was a barter, trading barter. That's the reason they came to what they had today. It works for example, pretty much a monetary system. We can get money. What's the most valuable thing in our lives today? It's about time. So we should give the best of our time to God.
One of the ways we can do that is by coming together for study, for worship, for prayer, for building up one another. And lest we think that our service and our sacrifice to God is accomplished here, this is a big part of it, but also as we go into the world, as we have opportunities to minister to others, as we have the opportunity to serve, as we have the opportunity to give and be generous, and to just reflect the light of Christ in the life of others, particularly those who don't know God. We're also to give in that way. Verse 5. Those descendants of Levi who received the priestly office have commandment in law to take tithes from the people, that is, from their brothers, though these are also descended from Abraham. So his point is, even among the people, the Levites and the priests were kind of elevated. Brothers though they were, they did receive tithes from the other Israelites. It wasn't because they were superior, but it's how God was providing for them. They received the tithes because God says they should, and not because they were greater. But then you get to verses 6 and 7, and this tithing becomes an issue of superiority in this particular transaction with Abraham and Melchizedek, where it says, this man who does not have his descent from them received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promise. So once again, there is this element of Melchizedek's superiority. When I talk about superiority, not talking about some sort of moral superiority or some sort of inherent value. Not saying that Melchizedek was a more valuable person than Abraham, but rather we're talking about status. We're talking about power. Okay? And if you think about how in the mind of a Jew, Abraham would be up there at the top. I mean, he's the father of the nation. And as great, at this point in verse 4, as great as Abraham was, he tithes to Melchizedek. He gives his 10%. And I notice this wasn't extracted from him as it was under the law. This was a voluntary free will offering, this recognition that Melchizedek was superior to him. And then Melchizedek turns around and he blesses Abraham. And so that indication of him blessing Abraham is an allusion also to the fact that he is in the superior position. As he goes on to say, it's verse 7, it's beyond dispute. The inferior is blessed by the superior. So the person who gives the blessing is greater than the one who receives the blessing. You don't go to someone inferior and ask them to bless you. You go to someone who is superior to you and you receive a blessing from them. So he's making this point that as great as Abraham was, Melchizedek was in a superior position. And again in verse 8, in the one case, tithes are received by mortal men, but in the other case, by one of whom it is testified that he lives. One might even say that Levi himself, who received tithes, paid tithes through Abraham. So this is really the final blow that shows the superiority of the Melchizedek priesthood as to that of the Levitical, verses 9 and 10, because the Levites were the one who received the tithes. However, there's a sense in which Levi, the father of the Levites and the priests, paid tithes to Melchizedek. Now, he kind of reaches that in a strange way logically, saying that Abraham tithed because Levi was going to come from Abraham's body. In a sense, Levi tithed to Melchizedek as well, and thus, once again, you have the inferiority of the Levitical and the superiority of that of Melchizedek. So that's kind of a strange argument, but at the same time, that's kind of a way that was reasonable back then. You remember those instances where you see this happening, where Rebecca, she's having a difficult pregnancy, and she's pregnant with twins, and she goes to the Lord to inquire what's going on, and Genesis 25:23, the Lord answers her. He says, two nations are in your womb, and two people shall come from you. Within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other. The older shall serve the younger. So we know inside her womb individually was Jacob and Esau. But the Lord was really looking down the line and saying, you've got these two great nations inside you. They're squabbling. If you trace the history of Israel and that of Esau, brothers though they were, they didn't get along very well. And we know how there's just a tendency to disagree and to argue and to deceive one another as they were growing up. Okay, so God looks down the line and says, you know, you've got two nations in your womb. So in a similar sense, he makes this argumentation that Levi tithed through the body of Abraham when Abraham gives the tithe to Melchizedek. So the big point of this really being verses 1 through 10 is to show Abraham's inferiority to Melchizedek. And he's going to bring that forth here as he looks at the priesthood here in just a moment. Dave, you want to have a word?
No, I'm just thinking that to me it always seems like you just have to pass it on. You just overemphasize.
The writer of Hebrews?
Yeah, right there. In that verse where you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, he's stacking evidence on evidence on evidence, isn't he? Yeah. But the reason being, well, this is kind of lost to us, although maybe it's remembered more out of your mind, I don't know. But to the Jews, this is a very significant argument, right? This is weighty, because they trace their lineage back to Abraham. They're thinking about going back to this Levitical priesthood, but he's giving them reason after reason after reason why the priesthood of Jesus is superior to that of Levi, which they're considering going back to. And so, We may get a little tired of seeing the same thing repeated over and over. This is a very heavyweight argument with him, which he's going to use to try to bring them back and draw them to Christ.
The fact about this too is that all the way through here, he's emphasizing on them how much better the new law is compared to the old.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of tithing, they had to give up the best they had in tithing. Now, it is no longer required that you do give as you have promised.
Mm-hmm.
And that is significant as to why, again, the new law is better than the old.
Yeah. Okay. So the method of giving isn't coerced. God wants us to give from the heart, right? And so, yeah, we've said from the beginning, the theme of the book of Hebrews is better, how Jesus is better than all of these things. And so you've got Jesus who's better than Moses, and you've got the old law is better, the new law is better than the old law. And here now his point is the new priesthood, Jesus, the new high priest, is better than the Levites and the old priesthood. Now let's move on, verses 11 through 17. Jim, would you read for us, please?
Therefore, if perfection were through the Levitical priesthood, or under it, the people received the law, what further need was there than another priest should rise according to the order of Melchizedek and not be called according to the order of Aaron? The priesthood being changed of necessity, there is also a change of the law. For he of whom these things are spoken belongs to another tribe, from which no man is initiated at the altar. For it is evident that our Lord wrote from Judah, of which tribe Moses spoke nothing concerning priesthood. And it is yet far more evident if he of the likeness of Melchizedek there arises another priest who has come not according to the law of a fleshly commandment, but according to the power of an endless life. For he testifies, you are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek.
Two big points that are going to come from this. He's going to show the weakness of the old covenant, and thus doing so, show the weakness of the Levitical priesthood. Yeah. His inability to perfect man so that he can stand before God. That's what man needs. That's what a high priest does, is he mediates between man and God. And he's going to show why that was insufficient under the old law, why the Levitical priests couldn't truly perfect man. And so therefore, there's this need for a new covenant and a new priest that can do that. And then he's going to put Jesus forth as that new priest and show how Jesus is able to do what the priests under the old law couldn't do. All right. So if priesthood had been unattainable through the Levitical priesthood, for under it, people received the law, what further need would there have been for another priest to arise after the order of Melchizedek rather than the one after the order of Aaron? So he's setting forth why there is this need for a new priesthood. So just kind of going through some of the things that we're going to look at in the verses ahead. So what are some of the differences between the two priesthood? Throw any out that you see.
Again, the sacrifices, the priesthood.
Okay. Okay. Yep. Giving a sacrifice is under the old law. Single sacrifice under the new. And he's really going to camp out on that later in chapters 9 and 10. Good. Okay. Right. So earthly sacrifices under the old law. Christ offers up his body under the new. That's a spiritual sacrifice, really.
The genealogy that we talked about, the old law, you know, they can trace back all the way back to here and further back.
Okay.
In both cases. I'm not sure, but I think by this time they'd already lost a lot of the records because they talked about the high priest for this year was such and such a man.
Mm-hmm.
His high priest, son in law, and all his other stuff. So I'm not sure. All their records even in the time of Christ.
There is some, there seems to be some, yeah, that's kind of a strange thing. There's two men set forth, Caiaphas and then Annas, his father-in-law.
Yeah.
So at this point in time, the priesthood has become corrupted.
Yeah.
The priests are of the Sadducee party. What do we know about the Sadducees, religiously?
Yeah,
they didn't believe in the resurrection. They didn't believe in angels. They didn't believe in the eternality of the soul. So all of the spiritual components of the faith, they didn't believe. Really what the priesthood had become at this point, during the days of Jesus even, was a political power. And so you've kind of got two men there, Annas and Caiaphas, and as you pointed out, Caiaphas is the high priest. It says Caiaphas is the high priest whenever Jesus is being prosecuted, and Annas was the high priest the previous year. I've done a little bit of reading on that. I can't call to mind exactly what it was, but I think there were some issues and God has kind of stepped in. As to the records, the Babylonians did this with some of them, but I think that they had enough to realize. And John, you may be able, you or Dick may be able to weigh in. During the Maccabean period, between the Testaments, wasn't the priesthood corrupted by that point? So they kind of broken from the pure lineage that had been set forth, and it seemed to be something almost a position you could buy or who you rub shoulders with. So that seems to kind of be the qualification there. Some of the other comparisons just between the Levitical and Melchizedekian is there were many Levitical high priests. And I wrote down somewhere in my notes how many there were. It seems like there were some 40 something high priests from Aaron all the way to the current point in time when Hebrews under the Melchizedekian, though, there's only one, and that is Jesus. So the priesthood of the Levites was temporary. That is, they served until they could no longer serve, but they served until they died. And the priesthood of Jesus is eternal, so there's no end to that. And then the Levitical priests all were sinners. They had to offer sacrifices for themselves before they could serve. Jesus had to offer no sacrifice for himself. He was the sinless Son of God. So all of those show why the priesthood of Melchizedek was superior to that of the Levites. So we'll pick up in verses 11 and 12. You're going to have next week in verses 11 through 17, and kind of work through that. A few more comments on some of the those things and the necessity for the priesthood to change along the way. Showing its inferiority.
second.
You want to turn to the invitation song, it'll be number 856. 856, and Alex will lead us in that here shortly.
Yeah.